Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and some of you may know that this past week marked the 100th anniversary of Brigadier General Billy Mitchell and the Air Service's 1st Provisional Air Brigade sinking the captured German battleship, the Ostfriesland. While this accomplishment was incredibly significant unto itself, this anniversary gives us an opportunity to consider Mitchell's accomplishments with a broader lens and think about what it all means today. And the reason for this is simple. If there is a single person who articulated a compass for air power, it's General Billy Mitchell. So, if you want to make sense of history, you need to understand a key factor. In the wake of World War I, one of the bloodiest conflicts ever seen on the face of the planet, a small group of airmen were confident that they had a better way to secure our nation's interests, one that would take less time, put fewer lives at risk, and achieve decisive results. Their courage, conviction, and dedication is what paved the way for the United States Air Force that our nation enjoys today. More importantly, their vision fundamentally changed what it meant to project effective military power. The results we achieved in World War II, the Cold War, Desert Storm, and beyond are undeniably tied to this vision. The Ostfriesland exercise epitomizes one of the most significant achievements, but the story is far broader. It is history that every airman and guardian should know by heart, strive to emulate, and look towards for inspiration. What these airmen did was far from easy. In fact, they laid their careers and individual well-being on the line for a simple belief that air power could make this country more secure and win wars with far less sacrifice. Their vision was so far-reaching that it took decades for their pioneering concepts to be matched by the technological art of the possible, namely stealth, speed, range, and precision. And in many ways, we're still pursuing the vision they defined a century ago, with the fundamentals of JADC2 and ABMS tying back to many of their original thoughts. All right, after that introduction, I am fired up to get this conversation going. So we've got General David Deptula.
Yeah, and I'm fired up too, Slick. Good to be here.
Got General Sutstream.
Cheers, Slick.
And Heather Penny.
How you doing? Good to be back.
I'm doing great. And Doug Berkey with us today.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Doug, I want to get started with you. Can you give us a rundown on Billy Mitchell? And given that we're talking about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Ostfriesland, bring us up to speed on those details as well.
Yeah, you bet. Billy Mitchell in 20 seconds. Okay, so the thing people don't really realize is he's actually a latecomer to aviation. He was in the infantry and the signal corps for years. It wasn't until his middle of his 30s that he actually took flying lessons and really began to figure out this new air domain. And he gained fame as a U.S. Air Combat Commander in France. You know, he led over 1,500 American and Allied aircraft in the San Miguel Offensive in 1918, which really made him the first Joint Force Air Component Commander, or JFAC in modern terms. And in many ways, he was inspired by the example that the Royal Air Force set when it became independent in 19 as a separate service, and they combined the air arms of the Army and Navy. And if you really want to understand this guy, you have to fundamentally get the fact that he saw the bloody, stalemated, disastrous ground fighting of trench warfare in World War I. It made a huge emotional impact on him, and he was convinced there had to be a better way, and he thought air power was that way. Because why would we just chew each other up in the trenches when you could actually go to the sources of enemy power and really collapse their warfighting potential? And so this is a guy on an actual mission here to advocate for this medium. I mean, he held it at the deepest level. And yet, he also was a guy that was very savvy. He knew how to handle politicians, the media. He was a celebrity in ways you can't even get your head around today. And this is a guy that also thought that change was only going to come about through a disaster in military outcome or public opinion. And so he really set his sights on the latter and really tried to influence public opinion. And he also thought, you know, that he had to solve two main areas, land warfare and control of sea, and air power could do both. So this is also a time when the Navy is trying to back out of air power. The Chief Naval Operations actually disbanded the Navy Aviation Division. He called it a lot of noise. And in 1920, and kind of in response to that, he told Congress that the Air Service could sink any battleship. And he called for a demonstration for this to occur. Well, the Navy was kind of watching this from the sidelines and was pretty nervous, and they conducted their own tests in secret, and they actually sank a battleship, but they kept it secret. Well, that didn't stay a secret too long. Word leaked out, and Congress urged Navy to do public tests, and so that really is what brought us to the Ostfriesland anniversary that we're discussing today. So he formed the 1st Provisional Air Brigade at Langley to carry out these tests, and they began June 21st, and they ran for about a month. They sunk a lot of ships, but the Ostfriesland was the main event. I mean, this thing had served at the Jutland. It was the battleships of battleships. It had survived 18 hits from enemy hits. I mean, it was unbelievable what it had done. And so it was planned in several phases for this, and 2 days of strikes, and the Navy wanted to go, you know, drop one bomb and then inspect and then have them drop another. And Mitchell at the end got fed up, and they literally clobbered it with a huge strike package, effectively. And watching this, were over 300 VIP observers. You had the Army Chief of Staff, the Secretary of War, Secretary of Navy, I mean, 18 members of Congress, and over 50 news reporters. This was huge in a level that's hard to get our head around today. I mean, we just saw what was worldwide news attention when you had, you know, civilian spaceflight go up with Richard Branson. This would be 500 times more than that. So the ship was sunk. The Army and Navy actually downplayed it, but the public got the message, and Mitchell really pushed it up harder in his advocacy. He was eventually court-martialed in 1925 for his public criticism of Army and Navy leaders and found guilty and resigned. He died in 36, but his ideas really lived on in his protégés, and those are really the air commanders of World War II. And there's one final thing here that really shows how long this debate continued to roll out. November 29th, 1941, for the Army-Navy football game, it included a picture of the battleship Arizona, and it is said, "It is significant that despite the claims of air enthusiasts, no battleship has yet been sunk by bombs." Well, clearly they forgot what happened in 1921, and they certainly weren't anticipating what was going to happen a few days later at Pearl Harbor. So, bottom line, this guy defined the compass for air power in ways that are still holding effect today.
Yeah, Doug, I can't say thanks enough for that summary, and it's pretty incredible what he did and how he led everything. So I want to go around the room and talk to everybody else and ask one question of how do you see Billy Mitchell's legacy in the United States Air Force?
Well, you know, Slick, I'll jump in here. I think Billy Mitchell's greatest legacy was setting the vision and mission for the Army Air Forces in World War II through his protégés, through his people. So you have Hap Arnold, Tui Spots, and Ira Aker. They were all young officers who worked with Mitchell. And so they were heavily influenced by his ideas and by his vision and the recognition of the potential for air power. And so when you tie their later leadership in World War II with his influence and what they began to think about at the Army Air Corps, or the Army Air Corps Tactical School, where they began thinking about long-range strike, the bomber getting through, what independent air operations, because they understood that air power is best utilized strategically and not under the command and not being penny-packeted like we saw in Castron Pass, right? So they were developing all of these ideas in the interwar years in the 1930s. And so his influence, even from the 1920s, began to extend throughout that decade. And if it wasn't for that, you know, for his influence, for what they worked through at ACTS in the 1930s, and then how they conceived of the combined bombing operations and the European theater, and then how they attacked the problem set in the Pacific theater, we would be, you know, living a very different world today, because the bombing operations is what fundamentally enabled landing on Normandy, you know, going and invading the European theater, and it's what prevented us from having to invade Japan. So when you think about the impact that Billy Mitchell had on the legacy of the Air Force, not only did his ideas and his vision for what air power could do, over and victory through air power, it fundamentally shaped the outcomes of World War II and what the Air Force would become.
Well said, Heather. I have to speak up here because the Cold War was interesting in that it put Billy Mitchell's philosophies about strategic bombardment or a strategic approach on full display. If you think about it, nuclear deterrence during that period was not about slogging in the trenches, although, you know, we're going to have to hold the Russians back in Europe, but it was really about putting on display our deterrence in terms of we were willingness to go and have the capability to go downtown into the Soviet Union and do some damage. And it was certainly on display. You know, General Deptula and I were part of that, being prepared to launch at any time, clear visible alerts, postures, and routes, training routes, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, we had two types of targets back then, counter value. We were willing to strike, you know, targets that would affect people, and then counter force. We'd take down their military force and not be in a World War One mode where we were going to slog it through with the Soviet Union. And that certainly was received, understood by the Soviets. And as far as we know, it worked. It works. So that was Mitchell on display. We got into trouble, though, in Vietnam. Strayed way far away from where Billy Mitchell would have us. And if there was a reverse legacy or a legacy that was a reverse lesson, it was in Vietnam. And, you know, the whole notion of that conflict being slowly, slowly growing, the gradualism that occurred there, and no longer were we willing to really use air power in an overwhelming way. It was applied in bits and pieces and tightly controlled by rules of engagement. And that was such a weak part of how we got to the end of the war. Of course, we can talk about Linebacker 2, a bombing campaign with B-52s, where the president, Richard Nixon at that time, allowed us to bomb the hell out of Hanoi, which did bring the Vietnamese government to the peace table and resulted in the closing of that war. So we have in the Cold War reinforcement of the legacy of Billy Mitchell, and we certainly have Vietnam to show us how we got off track.
Yeah, well, we got back on track, folks, was Desert Storm. Desert Storm's what saw technology finally match the vision of Mitchell and his associates, thanks to technological advancements in stealth, speed, precision, range, and what so many people forget about is an effects-based perspective for the use of those capabilities that Mitchell's vision presaged. But because of the equipment, he and even the leaders of air operations in World War II simply didn't have. Now, in Desert Storm, the Army would have the public believe that it was a 100-hour war, when in fact it was a 1,000-hour war, where the Air Force played a decisive role throughout all of it, and where the Army only fought in the final 10%, consolidating the victory achieved by air power, as General Mitchell and the vision of the founders of our Air Force predicted would occur. Now, if you fast forward 10 years, 12 years, to Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, those once again demonstrated the value of the Mitchell vision on the front ends of these campaigns and the danger of what happens when land-centric leaders drove those campaigns toward occupation and attrition-based warfare. It's instructive to remember that thanks to the application of modern air power in conjunction with a small footprint of special ops folks acting as ISR sensors, partnering with the Afghan Northern Alliance, achieved what these indigenous-friendly ground forces have been unable to accomplish in the previous 5 years, and that's the removal of the Taliban regime. But that was only one of three critical objectives directly affecting U.S. Security. The other two involved ensuring that a regime was in place that would ensure U.S. interests and elimination of the al-Qaeda terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. In just over 2.5 short months, these objectives were achieved because of the smart use of air power. The multi-trillion dollar question is, why did the United States and our coalition partners then pour hundreds of thousands of ground forces into Afghanistan over the next decades after these vital security objectives were realized? Now, folks, this isn't just a simple question of historical interest, because the answer illustrates the importance of using the right forces to act rapidly and effectively. And it was aerospace forces that can afford marked advantages that we saw demonstrated that was initially stated, advocated, and talked about by Billy Mitchell. They provide options. Air forces, aerospace forces, provide options that ground forces cannot, and they can do so without putting large numbers of America's sons and daughters at undue risk.
Yeah, I mean, that is obviously Billy Mitchell's motivation was to to not have us slog it out in the trenches and be on the ground for decades. So where are we today, and where do you all see Mitchell's legacy when you look at today's Air Force?
Looks like I think it's a mixed bag. You know, if you look at pursuing new concepts like joint all-domain command and control, you know, increased space-based operations, you know, you really see a lot of strong points in Mitchell's vision. You know, obviously, it's something like long-range strike with B-21. Again, it embraces it to a T. But when it comes to air-minded advocacy and education and that drive, you know, where the Air Force is backing off of key roles and missions, where the Army is rolling in with long-range fires that are organically controlled, and then really 20 years where nobody with an air-minded mindset like General Deptula, you know, said, stood up and said, hey, there's a better way. That's where they're coming off it. And I think it's a real challenge here. And so he'd be blown away by the technology, but he'd be pretty frustrated by the lack of advocacy to maximize it.
Yeah, I'll tell you that I get really disturbed because I understand when units where they're flying units where their close air support is their primary mission, where they say never forget the mission is an 18-year-old with a gun. But you know, but the problem is that that should be the last resort. I mean, if you take Billy Mitchell's vision, what we should be doing is preventing them from getting into a situation where we have to employ danger close CAS. I mean, that was the entire reason of creating air power that could hit long-range targets, those vital centers of gravity, is to avoid that kind of stalemate and meat grinder there on the ground.
You know, I will say where we're at today, we have a bit of a cultural problem, I think, in the U.S. Air Force. And we've been there for about 20 years. I think back, General Deptula was just talking about Operation Enduring Freedom. We were there together for Operation Anaconda, which was in 2002, where there was a valley of Taliban that we saw one of the largest modern-day army operations that was a disaster. However, the airmen just didn't speak up, and you know, a lot of the blame for how it didn't go well was thrown at the Air Force. So I was sent down to Tampa, to CENTCOM headquarters, to do a two-week forensics. Everybody who played in Operation Anaconda was there. And we went through that, and we made some really headway to show really the lessons. It was very Mitchell-esque, if I can use that term. But right about as they were to finish the report, Army major that was really on board with this came to me and said that he had been called by a three-star that said, you know, you're betraying the brotherhood here, and he was withdrawn from those forensics. Later, that report never saw the light of day. So the point I'm making is about attitude, that there just wasn't the gumption to really stick up for the principles that air-minded people, warfighters, believed in and knew about and were violated by our sister service. That needed to be a real underscored lesson in history, which has been lost. And since then, of course, a lot of the reportings in the books and the articles about Operation Anaconda make it out to be some success, and it was not.
Well, I think, you know, just to cap this off, when I hear Air Force officers coming over and saying, I'm not a Billy Mitchell zealot, as an opener, I mean, you got to be kidding me. You really don't get it if that's your opener, because what he fundamentally is talking about is not putting young 18-year-olds in a meat grinder. And if that's what you stand for, then okay. But fundamentally, I'm for trying to find more effective, efficient ways of securing our nation's objectives.
Yeah, Heather, you make a great point of close air support, you know, should be a contingency in the big scheme of things, not the overall plan. So I do really appreciate that, having been a CAS guy and done my fair share of engaging folks on the ground in protection of our U.S. forces and coalition forces. But so we've hit on a lot so far, and I want to shift gears a little bit and look at where do core Mitchell-defined roles and missions stand today?
Well, I'll tell you where they stand. They don't stand very tall, because none of the services other than the Air Force want to have a roles and missions review, even though one is desperately needed. And the reason they don't want to have that review is because they stand to lose. Now, let me state right here that I'm a extraordinarily strong believer in the notion of the construct of joint force operations. And I believe we need to have the strongest Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Space Force in the world. But the fact of the matter is we need to start making decisions on the basis of effectiveness first, efficiency second. But as we face a future where we're going to have declining resources, now we have to look across services to who can contribute the mostest at the leastest cost and in terms of both dollars and manpower. So we stand at a standstill in terms of defines a roles and missions review, but they're going to be imperative as we're going to have fewer resources, not less. Now, a bit about jointness, where we are today, something that didn't exist in Billy Mitchell's time. Jointness means that everyone, when they are in a service role, can strongly and effectively advocate for the roles of their respective services. That is being joint. It is being joint to be a strong advocate for what air power can do. You know, unfortunately, too many people have interpreted jointness as homogeneity, going along to get along, little league rules, like every service gets to play, when that's not the case. The beauty of jointness is a joint task force commander can pick the appropriate mix of service component forces to engage to meet the needs of a particular contingency. All right? And again, it's using the right force at the right place at the right time. And if airmen don't articulate what it is that they can provide, nobody else will. So that's where we are on roles and missions. And people who are members of the Air Force need to kind of shake off the last decade of go along to get along and start advocating for what aerospace forces can provide.
Well, sir, I'll jump in here and just say that regarding those Mitchell missions, right, long-range strike, strategic strike, air superiority, ISR, all of those right now are at risk because we don't have strong advocacy within the service, within the joint staff, and there in Congress. So you can have the vision, and you can be exploring the operational concepts, and you can be exploring the technologies, but the old saying goes, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. And the only way you get the bucks is through that kind of strong, unapologetic advocacy that Billy Mitchell provided. And as you said, because we're going along to getting along, we're risking all of those key capabilities that underpin the ability of our joint force to be able to operate. So long-range strike, yes, we have B-21 going on, but how old is our bomber force? So we're keeping B-52s, which will be how many decades old, at least 3 to 4 generations, have now flown that aircraft while we're retiring B-1s and B-2s when we've seen B-1s be operated at a higher ops tempo, at a high demand by the combatant commanders. And we know that the combatant commanders' appetite for long-range strike is not diminishing. It's not going away. It's only increasing. And so as we look at the demand for that long-range strike, we're now seeing the Army edge into that role and mission. When if you just objectively take a look, you know, unemotionally and, you know, without parochialism, take a look at what their operational concept is and the cost of it, it really just doesn't make sense. Air superiority, F-22 is canceled. We don't have the ability to truly provide air superiority or air dominance across a contested battle space. And it will be some time, I mean, NGAD, right? The next generation air dominance is potentially over a decade away. ISR, the ISR constellation and the various platforms. We have some advocacy there, but again, it's not as robust and it cannot meet the demand and the appetite for combat commanders and the joint staff. So this gets back to needing the advocacy for core roles and missions because no one else will.
All right, so obviously no one's perfect. So where did Billy Mitchell miss his mark?
Well, first look, I tell you, he didn't miss the mark. That said, he didn't have the greatest of people skills, and perhaps he could have gotten a little bit further by not punching people in the face to begin the conversation. For example, the irrepressible Mitchell constantly cast aspersions at his superiors, whose enthusiasm for air power, and for him personally, was strictly limited. Mitchell told people directly, quote, "The general staff knows as much about the air as a hog does about skating." And perhaps he should have spent more time working with Army leaders versus going head-to-head in such an aggressive fashion. If you take a look at what Arnold, Ager, and Spots did, they recognized this, and it shaped how they dealt with their Army counterparts, notably George Marshall. It's all about knowing when to fight and when to build relationships. And frankly, you know, in retrospect, I think during Mitchell's time, it was time to fight. So he might have been a bit aggressive, but it was necessary to wake people up. And by the way, he got the nation's attention, and they paid attention to what he had to say. And as a result, you know, he made air power's capabilities part of the solution for the broader defense establishment.
Okay, so if Billy Mitchell was here today, how would he advise today's Air Force leaders?
Well, I said it earlier, I think he'd be really proud of technology, but he'd frankly be losing his mind regarding the lack of effective advocacy and education at time, because the potential of what we can do right now is so tremendous. And coming out of 20 years of effectively a slow car crash of a disaster, where we just saw occupation and attrition warfare take so many lives and put people in such compromising positions and deliver so little, he would be going full throttle right now to advocate for more effective, efficient operations that air and space could deliver. But we're not really seeing that happen right now. So I think he'd be a frustrated leader.
I think you'd find it ironic and amusing, and that being the Army's advocacy for long-range missiles, UAVs, and space systems, that shows them fundamentally adapting an aerospace-centric approach. Although he'd chaff at the organic control and focus on the last tactical mile, he would also recognize that just like they wanted to own everything in the 1920s, today they're designing their own air and space-based ISR system, their own command and control systems, and their own commanders to control their new weapons, evidently forgetting that all those systems and commanders already exist in the Department of the Air Force and are committed to joint force operations. The Army doesn't understand joint in any way, shape, or form. And quite frankly, the Army views their forces as theirs and everyone else as joint.
I think he'd also lean on Space Force leaders to really push it up on adopting a warfighting mindset. I think he'd be really excited by the medium, but he wouldn't want them just to be a service provider to the other services or other, you know, combatant commands, et cetera.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the Space Force is the ultimate high ground. And, you know, in that line, you know, I think Mitchell would really rekindle that entire aerospace dialogue with the American public. I mean, he was so good at being able to educate the kitchen table about why air power and today why space power is so crucial to our nation's interests, our security interests, and how it underpins the joint force. So he'd be on every single kind of medium that that you could imagine. He'd be on social media. He'd be on the news networks. And he'd emphasize that it all comes down to leadership, right? So the way that we're seeing the Air Force make its future force decisions, the Air Force is focused on bean counting. They're focusing on balancing the budget. Bureaucrats are not going to be what wins the fight. It's going to take air-minded individuals embracing that air-minded compass and that air-minded vision. That's what it's going to require.
And here's what he would say. Airmen matter now more than ever, and it's okay to say that. In fact, it's an airman's obligation to stand up and highlight when options delivered through the aerospace domains afford more effective, prudent warfighting options. Like I said before, strongly advocating for your service is the essence of jointness, as the strength of joint operations is the synergy that occurs when force elements from all domains are applied to meet the demands of a particular contingency. However, in every contingency, one thing remains a constant. Today, aerospace forces are indispensable. No, repeat, no joint force operation can be conducted without the capabilities provided by the Department of the Air Force. That cannot be said about any other military department.
Well, it's clear that Billy Mitchell was a visionary. He was not afraid to state his position on what he thought about air power. And obviously, he sacrificed his own career in order to bring the Air Force that we have today. So appreciate everybody's views and discussion pieces, and especially what he would think of our Air Force today. So thanks everybody for being here.
Thank you, Slick.
Nice job, Slick.
Hey, man, thanks.
Thanks, Slick.
Well, with all of that, we are at the end of our time. And there is a key theme with today's conversation. People matter and a vision matters and consequences count. Can you imagine what World War II would have looked like if air power had been restricted to the tactical support role? That's exactly what would have happened without Mitchell. And just to be clear, D-Day would have been impossible and we would have seen an invasion of Japan. Fast forward a few years to the Cold War, and without Mitchell's vision, we would not have a vision for strategic deterrence that would work against the Soviets. And trust me, Army versus Army would have seen us lose. The Soviets simply outnumbered us. And any honest look at the past 20 years clearly shows that strategies focused on occupation and attrition warfare simply don't work. We honor personal sacrifice and commitment to duty, but we should have found a better way. What happens tomorrow comes down to airmen and guardians in uniform today. We hope they embrace the Mitchell example, both for what was good and what could have been done better. The country needs these views in the debate and for airmen and guardians to push for what air and space power can bring to the fight. We simply cannot win any other way. So to close this out, we've got a bit of a surprise. We found a rare audio clip of General Mitchell. So let's hear his take on air power in his own words.
There are and have been those in the United States who should be court-martialed for their deliberate suppression of our air power. Today, air power is the first line of defense of every country in the world. New York has no adequate air defense whatever. Today, at Mitchell Field, Long Island, there are only two obsolete bombers and eight observation planes for the defense of the greatest metropolis in the world, depending primarily on armies or upon navies. Armies can only entrench and hold land. Navies will be sunk during the first few weeks of war by air power. What determines the war today is the direct attack of the vital centers of an enemy. His water supplies, his means of obtaining food, his great cities, and everywhere where his people live and carry on their ordinary existence. Without air power, a nation is lost. And to keep air power under the Army and the Navy, it's the same as entrusting the development of a great electric light plant to an old candle factory.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.